Case number 21-7127 et al. ExxonMobil Corporation versus Corporación Cemex S.A. Cuba, Appellant, Corporación Cemex S.A. Panama, and Union Cuba Petroleo. Mr. Krinsky for the Appellant Cross-Appellee Corporación Cemex. Mr. Davidson for the Appellee Cross-Appellant ExxonMobil Corp.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Krinsky, please proceed when you're ready.
May I please reserve 1 minute for.
Would you do me a favor and can you lower the mic a little bit? Yeah, I think.
Better?
Yes, thank you.
Maybe the two mics at the side also.
Okay.
All
okay,
picking up.
Here we go.
Perfect.
Better?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, thank you. A plaintiff, ExxonMobil, sues for trafficking in expropriated property under Title III of the Helms-Burton Act. In 1960, Cuba expropriated an oil refinery owned by SOSA, a Panamanian corporation, and a subsidiary plaintiff, and also its auto service stations in Cuba. The property remains the property of the Cuban state itself. Plaintiff alleges that the Council of Ministers of Cuba put defendant Coupet's predecessors into possession of the property, and then Coupet for its operation, and that it did the same with respect to the auto service stations and Cemex Cuba, the defendant Cemex Cuba. We argue that the expropriation exception alone controls this action, and therefore the district court should have dismissed the action rather than, as it did, continue the action on the commercial activity exception. We argue that the expropriation exception alone controls the action for basically three reasons. The first is that the acts upon which Coupet and Cemex are being held liable are part and parcel of Cuba's exercise of sovereign authority, and therefore the case belongs only within the expropriation exception. The second reason is statutory construction. The third is international law. As to the first, liability under Title III, Coupet and Cemex's liability under Title III, arises from their possession or their use, or both, of the expropriated property. But in having the property in their possession and using it commercially, they are simply exercising Cuba's exercise, they're simply implementing, I should say, Cuba's exercise of sovereign authority. It's sovereign authority over the disposition of its own property. It's sovereign authority over the disposition of expropriated property. And it's sovereign authority to place this property within its socialist economic system by keeping it within the state sector.
Mr. Krinsky, can I ask you, in just pushing forward under the expropriation exception, is it your view that Barcelona Traction forecloses the possibility that Exxon might have rights under what we call municipal law in the international law context, that it might have rights under, let's say, Panamanian law?
No. Well, I think it doesn't matter. I think the question in a sense doesn't matter because it does not have any rights under international law, Panamanian law, or property rights. Under international law, Panamanian law, or U.S. law.
Well, I'm thinking to the extent that shareholders have a right to consent and the expropriation was taken in violation of that right, I mean, if the argument is Barcelona Traction forecloses a finding that this expropriation was in violation of international law, I guess the question is, does Barcelona Traction cover the situation in which it might the shareholders' interest might actually rise to the level of a legal right that is taken.
It would be a property right, Your Honor. On the Panamanian law, which I know plaintiff has raised in one sentence in its reply, only in its reply brief, I do want to point out that we believe that was waived. We argued Panamanian law did not provide rights in the district court. We put in an expert affidavit.
Understood. But on its merits, were we to reach it?
Excuse me. Yes, I do not think Barcelona traction precludes there being shareholder rights under municipal law. I don't think, personally, the point wasn't raised and wasn't argued and was waived. And it's really serious. We put in an expert affidavit, and there was no response at all from the plaintiff. But the provision itself is the right that was given under that provision was not taken away. They still had the right as shareholder to authorize or not the board of directors to dispose of its property for whatever property they had. It's similar to the situation with the Barcelona right of shareholder right of right to residual assets after liquidation. Well, if there's expropriation, there's less residual assets, but still your right, the residual assets that remain as a shareholder would not take it. So we would argue on a point that was never raised before that this right under Panamanian law. The other point is that—
But then it sounds like you are saying that Barcelona traction precludes the recognition here of any municipal shareholder rights under Panamanian law. For example, the right to consent. Sounds like you think that is foreclosed by Barcelona traction.
Well, it is.
For the reason that you just said, that they only have the right insofar as they have the property.
It's precluded by Barcelona traction in this sense, Your Honor, I would say, that it would not, Barcelona traction recognizes that in municipal systems and as customary international law, there's a basic separation between the right of the corporation and the right of the shareholder. If you would take a provision such as what we're talking about, that they cited in their reply brief, and we construe it as upsetting that basic structure, then I think it would be in conflict with Barcelona traction, Your Honor.
You started talking about Title III, and now you're flipping into some notion of international law. Isn't international law totally irrelevant to a claim under Title III?
It's not irrelevant, Your Honor, to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
No, I know. But under Title III, I mean, one of the things you said is this is not property under United States law. Title III is United States law, isn't it?
It is, but
let me finish. One of the findings that Congress made in passing Title III was that international law was inadequate with respect to the confiscations that were occurring in Cuba. And I think it's sub 8 or sub 9 or sub 10, all those findings. And property is defined as including securities in Title III. So Title III, it seems to me, number one, does not depend on international law. And number two, defines property in a way that's absolutely inconsistent with your argument.
Well, first, Your Honor, to go back to what I was starting to say, Title III did not amend the Sovereign Immunities Act. Did not amend the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. There was a provision in it originally to amend the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, but it was withdrawn. So we are left to apply the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Congress determined that any action under Title III against an agency must meet the requirements of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act.
Where does that determination come from? I don't see that. I've read Title III. You say that Congress determined Title III is subject to the immunity requirements?
There was a provision in the bill that said actions under Title III are exempt from immunity, and it was withdrawn.
So which bill?
It was in the House. Well, the House bill was what originally went forward.
It could have been withdrawn simply because it was unnecessary. And the reason it was unnecessary is the same reason we gave in the Mower case, that this is not simply a cause of action. It's an action that says that the Cuban agents are liable if the property has been confiscated and is being trafficked, which is namely being used. And that defines what the liability is.
Your Honor, the reason why there was a waiver of immunity on the basis of that statute is that otherwise that statute would be a dead letter. It would be meaningless. It would be senseless. That's not so here, Your Honor. Plaintiffs can sue. In fact, plaintiff has sued under Title III within the constraints of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. And its requirements must be met. One of the requirements is that there be a particular kind of right at issue under the expropriation section, a property right. Title III only gives damages. It doesn't create a right in the property.
Have there been non-state defendants in Title III cases?
There are a ton of them, Your Honor, in Florida. Yes, Your Honor. And they are different than us because they entered into a relationship with the expropriated property, if you will, through a simple contractual relationship. Carnival Cruise docks at a wharf in Havana and disembarks its passengers over a confiscated wharf. But that is separated from the
There's no FSIA issue in that kind of case.
Exactly. This is the first case. And I would point out the agency provision Title III doesn't apply just to Cuba. I mean, French state agencies, English, Canadian, so forth,
Title III
the ambit of Title III.
Title III only applies to Cuban confiscations.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's true. No. Any person who traffics in confiscated property.
Oh, who
person is defined as?
But the expropriation has to have been done by the Cuban.
Yes, government. Your Honor. Yes, it's a Cuban bill.
Yes. Sure. And you keep talking about sovereign authority. I don't think there's any dispute about sovereign authority. The United States has sovereign authority to take property. The question is whether it's a violation of international law to take the property and not compensate the person that owned it. That's the question. It's not the question of exercise of sovereign authority.
I believe that's right, Your Honor, and that's why the expropriation exception applies. Under the expropriation exception, and it alone is where Congress said, we are going to make a weighty decision that we are going to allow a suit on the basis of a sovereign act.
But when you say, I mean, obviously you don't think the expropriation exception is met. When you say it applies, what you're saying is there's only one conceivable way.
Yes,
that exactly. This suit can go forward and would be under expropriation.
We don't concede that.
Why is that?
We spent 20 pages arguing it was still a violation.
Right. I mean, I don't understand why that would be the right way to read the act. You could conceive of this case as an expropriation case, and obviously there's ways in which one could. The statute, Title III, even talks about the original expropriation as distinguished from the ongoing trafficking. It could be conceived of that way, but there's also another exception that's potentially in play. It just seems like the natural way you read that statute is that there's multiple exceptions. You kind of go down the list and see if any of them applies.
That may be the case in other cases, Your Honor, but I would suggest this is fundamentally different because, and the reason is really expressed wrong in Ivanenko, it reflects the same fact. There is no separation here between what the agency is doing that makes it liable and Cuba's exercise of sovereign authority. Wrong and Amengo recognize the transfer, the state's transfer of the expropriated property to an agency for its commercial use, it's a sovereign, not a commercial act. Well, if one end of that same transfer is sovereign, then surely the other end has to be sovereign as well. It's part and parcel of the same sovereign transaction, a transfer of property. And here, what's more, it's the transfer of the state's property. So, I mean, if the United States put part of the Colorado River in the hands of the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Tennessee Valley Authority carrying out its mandate, that's a sovereign exercise of authority. Not how it carries it out, not a contract, not an independent act, but it is part and parcel of the same sovereign exercise of authority.
What about DeSepel, where there was a sovereign act of confiscation, but then we've applied the commercial activities exception?
Because there was a contract. They were suing on a contract, on a bailment agreement.
But here there's
trafficking. There's trafficking. There's use of expropriated property to run a business.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's different than...
And the bailment, there was a bailment that arose as a matter of law. It wasn't like they wrote it out.
There was a bailment, matter of law or not, there was a bailment. Here, there is nothing more than the state, the agency having in its possession, being put in possession of property and being told to use it for commercial use. It's not about how they are using it. It's not about how they are, there's no independent tort, it's not about a contract, it's nothing independent from that exercise of sovereign authority. I think the district court went off in the wrong direction when it asked whether the act is in connection with a commercial activity. But Nelson settled that, well, if the act is sovereign, it doesn't matter whether or not it's a connection with a commercial activity, it's still sovereign. And that's what we have here.
So suppose that what happens, the trafficking that's alleged, the commercial trafficking that's alleged involves the issuance of bonds. And the action is that, well, you issued some bonds and now you're reneging on the bonds because you're extending the time frame. And it all happens on expropriated property. I mean, it's obvious under Weltover that it would be the commercial activities exception.
Yes, Your Honor, but it would be indeed. That's how the state or the agency participates in the marketplace. What we're talking about is the solid decision about not how you participate, but who participates in the Cuban economy with what property. And those are sovereign acts. What if Cuba had issued a regulation that said only state enterprises can use expropriated property? But surely we would recognize that's the flip side of Weltover. That's the part that Weltover recognized as sovereign. But that's what essentially they did. Instead of passing, there probably is a regulation somewhere, but they probably, instead of passing a regulation saying only state enterprises can use the oil refinery, they gave it to a state enterprise and said, you possess it, you run it. It's the same exercise of sovereign authority.
But I don't think the question is who. I think it is how. For example, in the DeSepel case, I think the government of Hungary made an argument about the trains and the museum being part of the state. And we looked at the function, not at the who, but at the how, you know, but these are things that can be in our functions that can be in our carried out commercially. And that seems like that's a robust and well-established strand in both the Supreme Court's cases and ours.
That maybe have been the facts, Your Honor, the arguments, but the decision rested very explicitly on there being a bailment agreement. A bailment agreement is a contract, comes within the restrictive theory of immunity.
There are many contracts by these state enterprises, CMEX is entering into contracts.
But that's not what makes them liable. What makes them liable, what Helms-Burton does, is makes them liable for possessing property given to them by the state or using the property given to them by the state.
Right, and using
it. Using the property they were given to the state.
I know, but still, it could be a subsequent purchaser, person who has control over the property, and using is just commercially using it in the way that any private party might commercial selling goods.
It's not a private party when you're carrying out the state's exercise of authority, of sovereign authority, to dispose of its property, dispose of expropriated property, to keep property within in the public sector. Look what we would be saying if this is not a sovereign act. We would be saying that Cuba cannot, in its exercise of sovereign authority, structure its economy to have its oil refinery, key industries within the state sector.
So even if we were to accept this argument, the upshot of which is that the relevant acts in issue are sovereign acts.
Yes,
you can still apply the commercial activity exception and reach that conclusion. You would just say under the commercial activity exception at the first step, it doesn't constitute commercial activity. It sounds to me like that's the upshot of your argument. That doesn't mean that you only apply the expropriation.
I think not, Your Honor. I think if the act is sovereign in character, which we maintain it is, it doesn't matter whether it's also in connection with commercial activity. In Tehran, Your Honor, we're a stronger case than in Tehran. In Tehran, there was the state's property, and there was actually a contract, a concession. But then there was allegedly a breach of that a contract. The court nonetheless said, this is within the expropriation exception, not the commercial activity exception. Here we're stronger. There's no contract. They're not suing on a contract. They're suing on the core, bare, naked sovereign act of the agency being told, here, you take this property and you use it commercially. And that happens all the time. That's exactly what happened since 1917 with expropriated properties.
Is Tehran a precedential decision of this court? I'm sorry, I don't know why my microphone is not effective, but is Tehran a precedential decision of this court?
No, Your Honor, I think not. But I think it illustrates the point that when you're dealing with the state's own property, and the state disposes of it the way it wants to, then that is a sovereign act.
So can I take you, just to go to another step of the argument. I know you've made an enthusiastic and forceful submission that we have to do this under the expropriation exception and that it's a sovereign act. But let's just assume for argument purposes you'll resist the assumption, but assume for argument purposes that not persuaded by that. I'm not saying I'm not, but let's just assume that I'm not for present purposes. And we apply the commercial activity exception.
I'm glad you're on, appreciate the time.
And so on that, let me just ask you the question. So the district court had two particular channels through which it concluded that the commercial activity exception was satisfied, one of which was the remittances and one of which was the sale of U.S. imported goods at the stations. And just to focus on the remittances for a second. So on the remittances, if it's true that the SOSA, is that how you...
SOSA.
Yeah. Okay. If there's an entire program that's designed to get remittances from U.S. persons, so that persons from the U.S. can send funds to persons in Cuba, then does it not just necessarily follow that there's a direct effect in the U.S. as a consequence of creating and maintaining that program?
The problem is that there were only 4 to 10, at most 4 to 10, out of 504 remittance locations on SOS land. Only 4 to 10 out of 500.
So on that, if that's your main response, and that doesn't surprise me, that would be a main ingredient in response. So let's just suppose that in those, let's just assume 4 to 10. I mean, I think there'll be a response that says, well, if there's more discovery, maybe we'll find out there's more than 4 to 10. But let's just stay in 4 to 10 land. So in 4 to 10 land, if one of those four, let's just give you the benefit of the four. If one of those four is processing millions of dollars in remittances, then you're past the triviality threshold of Weltover at millions of dollars. Well, Weltover tells us it doesn't need to be substantial. Then why isn't that enough? Even if it's only one, I'll just give you the benefit of one. Why isn't it enough? We don't know how much any particular station is processing. Why isn't it enough?
Because it's, respectfully, Your Honor, it's the wrong question. Okay. The question is whether the 4 to 10 was the cause of the remittances flowing. And the district court did not make that finding. It missed the boat. And what we think the court should do is either remand for the court to address that question of whether the 4 to 10 is the cause. We say proximate cause, but it really doesn't matter for this moment. It's the cause of the remittances flowing. We don't think it's plausible, 4 out of 504. And by the way, you know, Exxon has a list of, say, of remittance locations. It could say if it's more than 4 to 10, but they haven't said that.
Causality, the 4 to 10, I get that for purposes of Title III. But for the FSIA, all that matters is if the act causes a direct effect in the U.S.
But did it?
And
the district court never addressed the 4 to 10. He didn't address it. He respectfully missed the boat. He said, well, there was a contract between Western Union and FinCEMEX, a related company, opened up a channel of communication and remittances flowed. But the question then is, did the 4 to 10 cause, part of the cause, we say approximate cause, but anyway, cause Western Union and FinCEMEX enter into that contract? That's the question. And because it's the contract that makes the remittances flow. And that there's 4 to 10, we say, is the district court didn't say it, and Exxon doesn't even elect it. Exxon does not even argue. They didn't argue below, they didn't argue here, that the 4 to 10 were a cause of opening up this channel of remittances. The district court asked the wrong question. It didn't focus on the 4 to 10.
Suppose it's 100%.
I think that would be a harder question, Your Honor.
Let me just finish. I'm not asking if it's a harder question. I'm asking whether under your argument, you would still say, even if every single facility was one in which remittances were coming from the U.S. to Cuba, are those facilities causing the remittances to
fail? I think we would have to ask, Your Honor, whether there was an intervening act, an individual, independent assessment by Western Union or whether it was really relying on those 504 locations. I think that would be the factual inquiry.
I'm hung up on this, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you know, I've been overseas and received Western Union wires and in facilities, but it was always Western Union had a separate office. Is that the same in Cuba with respect to these 7-Elevens?
There's a sign on the door, on the auto service station door. They sell gas, and there's a sign on the door that says Western Union.
But is there a Western Union office in there with a Western Union?
Western Union appointed FinCEMEX as its agent in Cuba to distribute remittances. Okay. FinCEMEX appointed 3 sub-agents to do that. FinCEMEX is one of them. There are the 3 sub-agents provide 504 locations. Only 4 to 10, the magic number here, 4 to 10 is on SOS land.
Just following up from Judge Randolph's question, it's more like when you buy a lottery ticket from a retail outlet, in the United States. They have a sign on the door that they sell them. You go to the cash register and they will process the lottery tickets from their, just as part of their, the products that they sell, right? So it's not a separate office. What I find challenging for you about the commercial activity exception, both with foodstuffs and with the remittances, is two things. The Title III claim is very broad. The Title III authorization for a private right of action using the expropriated property in putting it to commercial use, very broad. And then the type of outfit that we have here, these sort of convenience stores that do a lot of things, including in some cases, process remittances, sell various goods, including the evidence suggests in some cases, US goods. So it seems like maybe an unusual case, but why shouldn't we find that the direct effects of on the US of purchasing US goods and processing US remittances are related to the gravamen of the claim, that commercial activity of running convenience stores, and the direct effect of doing so insofar as if they weren't running those convenience stores, at least some of that type of business would no longer be coming into Cuba.
Yes, Your Honor, maybe that should be the finding, but it wasn't the finding. The district court didn't focus on the right question. Where is the causality for using expropriated property? And maybe the district court will decide on the evidence, on the current evidence or on additional evidence, that it is the causality requirement is met, but the district court didn't do it. And so we should have a remand for the district court to make, look into the facts and make that finding. Because there is no finding of causality from the use of expropriated property. That is what has to cause a direct effect. There's simply no finding.
Do you draw a distinction between remittances and the sales of U.S. imported goods with respect to this point you just made, that the district court, in your view, didn't make the right finding in terms of causation?
Well, I think the key on the foodstuffs is that the district court said that further factual development might lead it to conclude that the foodstuffs were not a direct effect. It stated that explicitly. And he said, well, so far, what you've given to me is not enough to dismiss this action. But it explicitly said further factual development might lead me to a different conclusion. And so a remand for that purpose, as well as the purpose I just mentioned on the remittances, seems to me entirely the appropriate.
Well, why do we need to remand at all on the foodstuffs if the district court is already going to do what you're saying we should remand for the district court to do?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. I thought what you had just said is that the district court is already saying that it's going to conduct further discovery on the foodstuffs, and that further discovery might end up reaching a resolution in your favor. Why would we remand for the district court? I mean, why would we need to tell the district court anything on foodstuffs if it's already going to do what you think it should?
I think that's a fair point, Your Honor. It's a peculiar posture because it's interlocutory. But I think on the Western Union, it's quite different. I think the court should identify the issue which the district court should look at and decide upon, which is whether there's causality based upon the use of service stations to pay out Western Union remittances.
And are you asking for a reversal and entry of judgment in your favor on jurisdiction, or are you just saying? It sounds to me like the primary submission you're putting forward is that you ought to have a chance to go further in the district court to meet your burden to show. That the exceptions to the FSIA are inapplicable.
We argue, first, of course, that the expropriation exception alone controls, and that ends the case.
Got that.
When we get to commercial activity section with respect to CMEX, which is the only party that the court reached on the commercial activity exception, that we do argue that on the record, the judge should have dismissed the claim under the commercial activity exception. We also argue that if the district court, if it wasn't, if it should, if that's wrong and it shouldn't have dismissed, it shouldn't have denied the motion. And it should continue to examine the question which it failed to recognize as the key question.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
And it deals with the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission.
Yes, sir.
Right. Well, why isn't that a waiver or or an exception to any sovereign immunity that Cuba has, that the federal government has authorized a commission to award damages against Cuba and in fact did it to the tune of, what was it, $71 million? When was that, 19, what?
The commission was set up in 64, I think, and that decision was probably 67. But it wasn't a decision.
Why isn't that a waiver or a disregard of sovereign immunity?
It's not an award to the plaintiff. It's a certification to the Secretary of State for possible use in diplomatic negotiations with Cuba, state-to-state negotiations. It's not a war award. You can't sue on that. It's a certification to the United States, to the State Department.
Well, you can now. You can sue on it now.
No, I don't.
Title III entitles you to a presumption that your property has been taken and the amount of damages awarded by the commission. That's a suit on that award, isn't it?
But you have to show it's your property. And they haven't shown it's their property.
Well, not under FISA, but certainly it showed almost conclusively a presumption that it was their property. Otherwise, the commission could not have rendered the award.
The presumption you're referring to, I believe, Your Honor, is about the amount of damages. But the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission did was fine, as was totally within its statutory mandate to tell the Secretary of State. What it did was that Exxon, as a shareholder of a corporation whose property was expropriated, suffered indirect economic injury, damages. Well, maybe it did. Maybe the Secretary of State someday will raise that with the Cuban government, but that's not a property right. And remember when we were talking, Helmrich made it very clear, we're talking about a particular kind of right here under the expropriation section. We're talking about a property right. The indirect economic damages is not a property right under international law, possible retraction, Panamanian law, under any other.
Under Title III, you know how property is defined under Title III?
I have read it, Your Honor.
Yeah. The term property means any property, including patents, copyrights, trademarks, any other form of intellectual property, whether real, personal, or mixed, any present, future, or contingent right, security, or other interests therein, including a leasehold interest.
But those
and you right. Say that doesn't cover the loss that Exxon claims?
No, those are SOSA's property. It was SOSA's property. It owned the property. It had all these things. The question becomes, and the notion that this shareholder has a property interest in the corporation's property is flatly contrary to possible attraction, and all that plaintiff can rely on is lex specialis, treaty provisions. Negotiated to get more than our customary international gave.
Can I go back to just and then we'll give Exxon a chance to argue, unless my colleagues have further questions. I just have one question on commercial activity. Mm-hmm. And on commercial activity, and put aside remittances for a second, and let's talk about the foodstuffs. CMEX has a supply contract with Allenport, and Allenport gets goods from the U.S., and then CMEX ends up taking those goods and selling them at the stations, as I understand it, at a high level of abstraction. is the reason that CMEX has a contract with Allenport so that Allenport can get goods from the U.S., since Allenport, as I understand the record, is the only entity that can import from the U.S.?
CMEX's contract is not for Allenport to get goods from the United States.
I know that's right.
Allenport, I think it's important to note. I mean, Allenport imports food from the entire world for the entire country of Cuba.
I get that. I guess my question is this, though. I think I do understand that, and I appreciate the clarification. But because Allenport, as I understand it, is the only entity that can import from the U.S., it may import from all over the place. But because it's the only entity that can import from the U.S., is the reason that CMEX has an agreement with Allenport so that CMEX at least has access to U.S. goods, since Allenport is the only entity that can get goods from the U.S.?
There's nothing in the record that CMEX cared at all where the food came from. It has a supply contract for, not these oil service stations. CMEX wants many,
right?
Tremendous distribution network. It says, we want, in the coming year, we want, you know, 50,000 chickens. It doesn't care where the chickens come from. There's nothing in the record indicating where the chickens come from.
And
so, so then you have the question of causality.
Isn't Mr. Krinsky, isn't Allenport also the exclusive importer from elsewhere? It is the importation arm, no?
Well, if
CMEX wants to import from Spain, does it go through Allenport?
Probably, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that it's a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
Allenport is the major, by far the major importer of food from around the world from Cuba.
Is it not entirely foreseeable that as a result of CMEX's purchase orders, Allenport will import goods from the United States?
I would say, Your Honor, on this record, it's entirely not foreseeable. Allenport makes its own, the record is, and maybe even further factual, and I think that's the district court's alluding to, wanting to have more development. The factual record is Allenport makes its own decision, totally independent of whether CMEX or anywhere else is going to carry the goods, about how much of the country's needs it's going to import from the United States, or from, and it's mostly, overwhelmingly, not from the United States. So the question,
and when you say it's mostly overwhelmingly not from the United States, do you mean with respect to the service stations or with respect to CMEX as a whole?
The whole country.
Do we know with respect to the service stations?
No.
We don't know.
We don't know. That's not in the record, Your Honor. No. And the record on food stamps, I would suggest, is seriously underdeveloped. And the district court for decision, and the district court recognized that.
Make sure my colleagues don't have further questions from you. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Krinsky. Mr. Davidson.
Morning. Hey, please the court, Stephen Davidson for Exxon Mobil Corp, the plaintiff below, appellee, and cross appellant. And I will discuss our response to Mr. Krinsky's appeal and our cross appeal, reserving a couple minutes of rebuttal for our cross appeal. As is clear, there are, according to Exxon Mobil, two pathways for subject matter jurisdiction here. One is under the FSIA and the two exceptions we say apply, the commercial activity exception and the expropriation exception. Another is a direct case under Title III itself. And I'll take up that argument second, but that argument is that under Title III, there has been a waiver of sovereign immunity and that we don't need even to resort to the FSIA. We can just deal with Title III. The judge below ruled against us on that point. And we pled in the alternative as to both relief under the FSIA and Title III itself. And within the FSIA, we said two exceptions apply, the commercial activity exception and the expropriation exception. So turning first to Mr. Krinsky's appeal and our response to that, We would submit that the district court got this right on the commercial activity exception, and principally by focusing on trafficking, because trafficking is what we are entitled to sue under. Not possession of the property, but sue as an American citizen, sue those who traffic in our property. And I believe the district court in his ruling was correct when he said, quote, the act does not grant a cause of action for mere expropriation of property. Rather, liability under the act attaches only when a U.S. person's property has been confiscated and trafficked. Trafficking in expropriated property is the gravamen of the Title III claim. We would submit the district court correctly relied on Sachs in dismissing, as you heard in argument this morning, the one element approach as flatly incompatible with the court's precedent. And, Your Honors, the trafficking activity we have sued under is fundamentally commercial. The remittance program, the foodstuff program. So we would submit we fall squarely within the ambit of the commercial activity exception. And as I think was mentioned earlier in argument, the breadth of the definition of trafficking and property under Helms-Burton is very broad. It includes a wide range of covered commercial acts, as well as a catch-all provision for engaging in commercial activity using or otherwise benefiting from confiscated property. And then if you look at this court's precedent and the Supreme Court precedent, we believe we fall squarely within those decisions with respect to the commercial activity exception. We principally rely on Weltover, direct effect when money was paid into the U.S., sovereign acting as a private commercial act. Successful, which has been discussed and raised by Judge Pillard. It involved expropriated property, but still there was a commercial activity. And then we would look at your direct effects jurisprudence, principally in Cruise Connection and the AIG Energy.
So in our cases, we have said that nothing in the FSIA commercial activities exceptions direct effect requirement requires that the direct effect harm the plaintiff in the United States, which is helpful to your claim. But I don't think we've ever found a direct effect where the act upon which the action is based, the gravamen, the direct effect that it has in the United States, doesn't cause harm in the United States. Is there harm in the United States from the Cuban market being available to United States Western Union, to United States foodstuffs?
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that that question is phrased too narrowly in connection with your precedent. The direct effect can be manifested through what Judge Mehta called, and I think is also in the EIG case, a direct negative economic effect. That is, funds flowing out of the United States or funds that were supposed to be paid into the United States and weren't. So it's not so much, with all due respect, I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as harm. I would say effect. And I would fasten onto the word effect because that's the word of the statute, not harm. And your jurisprudence allows for there to be a negative economic effect. And I think if you look at how Judge Mehta analyzed the record and analyzed these two.
When you say negative economic effect, you mean unharmful economic effect?
Negative and harmful are relatively synonymous, but negative in the sense that money flows out of the United States or money that should have flown in. Doesn't, like in the bonds case.
Weltover. But those are really two different things from the perspective of negative. If the U.S. is supposed to receive funds that it doesn't receive, well, that's both a non-action, so negative in that sense, but it's also bad for whoever wanted to get the money. Whereas here, it's a non-action in the sense that the goods are, the demand is being created to pull goods out of the United States, but it's not adverse in any sense, because as I said, it's a bigger market for the purveyors of those foodstuffs and remittance services.
Your Honor, what direct effect requires is that there's conduct specifically, economic conduct specifically targeted at the U.S. and that there is an effect in the U.S. of that. And I would submit that harm isn't necessarily what the FSIA is aimed at with respect to direct effects, because as Your Honor mentioned, there are cases under the FSIA where simply being harmed isn't a direct effect. Like, you know, there are a number of FSIA cases in which a plaintiff sues. I mean, one could say in SAC, you know, the plaintiff is injured in the United States, but that's not a direct effect. It's not necessarily harm. It's an economic effect.
I mean, in your view, in other words, it seems to me that your argument is that it could be a beneficial effect because the purpose of the FSIA exception is to establish enough of an economic nexus to the U.S. that it seems fair to hail the defendant sovereign into U.S. court. And even if it's a beneficial effect, that's still an effect of the kind that justifies bringing the sovereign defendant into U.S. court. Is that your view? So your answer to Judge Pillard would be, I think that, yeah, even if the cases don't deal with situations in which there hasn't been a harm, it doesn't matter, because even if it's a beneficial effect, it's still an effect per the language of the statute and per the underlying purpose, which is to make sure that there's enough of a commercial nexus to justify bringing the sovereign defendant to U.S. court.
I would agree, and I would also remember we're dealing with a fairly novel situation in that the actual cause of action is for trafficking. So this case, in some ways, is unlike FSIA cases that have preceded it, because it's on this special kind of cause of action of trafficking rather than, you know, a breach of contract or other kinds of things. It's a very broad remedy that applies to a lot of different conduct.
Is there another case, for Judge Pillard's question, is there another case where it actually went in this direction, where one could conceive of the commercial consequences as being beneficial to the U.S., but nonetheless, it's the basis for establishing jurisdiction?
Well, if you look at the Weltover case, I mean, there was direct effects. I mean, some of the bond payments were made, so there was money going back and forth. I mean, ultimately, they sued when a bond payment was missed, but I would submit that the direct effect is still satisfied, even if a bond payment is made.
Just stepping back, I take it you agree that the effect, the act that causes the direct effect of the United States has to be the act that is the gravamen of the claim. So here it's the running of the use of the commercial use of expropriated property to run the series of convenience stores in Cuba.
Right,
so that is the gravamen.
Right, it's trafficking, and then here we would say that translates into the use of the confiscated property for these commercial purposes. And
right.
Remember, the property we're talking about with respect to these two, the foodstuffs and the remittances, are these confiscated service stations.
Right. And what about this, what just appears to be quite incidental amount of remittance business that is run through the CMEX owned, and the particular stations that, at least as far as defendants can tell, that were the stations that were expropriated from SOSA 4-10.
A few points in response, Your Honor. First, you know, the one that Chief Judge pointed out, that we haven't had discovery. We don't know actually.
Did you preserve a claim that you need discovery on that?
Yes. But we believe that, to sort of have our cake and eat it too, it's also unnecessary,
mm-hmm,
because 4-10 is enough.
Why?
Because remember, the standard here is non-trivial. And let's talk about the remittance program. In the 2018, there was $3.6 billion.
Overall. Do we know the quantity through?
We don't. And there are, from the evidence and below, there are 66 Western Union machines or remittance machines at CEMEX stores. And defendants have admitted that 4-10 of those are in confiscated service stations. That's the record. And then the question is that non-trivial? There's literally billions of dollars going into these 66 or the 502 remittances, 66 of which are at service stations. Any one of these 4 to 10 could be hundreds of millions of dollars a year in money that's going through. And I would submit it's very unlikely it's not in several, if not tens of millions of dollars. And the question is that non-trivial? And we wish the record in some ways was better, but we, of course, don't have access to these stations. The discovery wasn't, you know, the judge said we have enough to find non-trivial without doing this discovery.
Would it matter whether it's part of CMEX's business plan or whether it's only part of, what is it, FinCMEX?
FinCMEX.
That some of these remittance receipt sites are in service stations? I mean, it seems to me that it's clearly part of CMEX's commercial use of the property that it sells foodstuffs.
Right.
Less clear that it is sort of part of the program of CMEX in running these, that it allows people to pick up their remittances. Are they accommodating somebody else's business plan? Does that matter?
Well, CMEX, I mean, it might be FinCMEX, but an entity in the CMEX chain has a contract with Western Union to provide
right.
these remittances. And they decided that it's in these service stations, among other places. There are 500 locations in Cuba, 66 in service stations. So I would submit it's part of their plan to have these in service stations to allow for greater convenience and greater use of the remittance stations.
Do we know whether these 4 to 6, I don't think we do, but are rural, remote, or
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, as to where the 4 to 10 are. But we would submit that the judge was right, that it's non-trivial.
What's your response to CMEX's argument that the way to look at the 4 to 10 is to ask whether that small number of stations, and I mean small relative to the overall number of stations, actually causes the outflow of dollars from the U.S., of funds from the U.S. to Cuba?
Well, we know that they, by their own admission, they're 4 to 10 that use the Western Union remittance program. So I think we can take as a given there is some money flowing. So the question, only question in my mind, is does that get over the non-trivial ball? Because it's certainly flowing. And as I said in response to Judge Pillard's question, we believe the judge is right. It's clearly non-trivial.
But is that really answering the question in the sense that if the gravamen of the claim has to cause the direct effect, then wouldn't the question be, it seems reasonable at least to assume that the same amount of remittances would be sent and that the people in Cuba who are picking them up would just have a very marginally fewer choices about where to do that. So isn't there some at least modeling needed to say whether there is any effect on the outflow of remittances from the United States of the availability of these 4 to 10 stations? At least that's what I take, you know, the defendant's argument on this to be.
Well, I think to the extent we're getting into the purpose, I think the case law is clear that we don't necessarily have to look at
just
the
cause a direct effect. That's what I'm focusing on. Does it cause this effect?
Again, there are 4 to 10 of these stations where, I mean, could you, I guess your hypothetical, your question presumes, well, if there weren't those 4 to 10, would the money still go anyway?
Right. Yeah. Same amount of money.
Well, the first answer is I don't know, because these 4 to 10 may be in some place where the people who use them can only access them there. Maybe they don't have a car, they walk there, or, you know, it's on the other side of the island. So there are plenty of explanations as to why the 4 to 10 are essential to some amount of commerce being transmitted. And I think one could perhaps take the logical progression that if there are fewer of these, there'd be fewer transactions and less money transmitted. But I don't know, frankly, if the standard would be so exacting that we would have to prove absent the 4 to 10, would there still be money? I mean, I think what we need to prove is what we did prove and what the judge found, which is 4 to 10 is non-trivial.
Do we have any idea what the transactions are between Western Union and Cymex? I mean, does Western Union rent space, or do they pay a license fee or whatever?
I don't know the exact particulars of that relationship.
I wonder whether it matters, because it seems to me if there was a fee, somehow or another, rental or leasehold or whatever, that if it's not turning a profit, Western Union would shut it down.
Well, I mean, I think it's a given that Western Union makes a profit on it. I mean, they charge a fee for the transmission that comes out from the sender or the receiver. And I don't know whether CEMEX has to pay Western Union a fee or vice versa for using their facility.
I was going to shift to foodstuffs if you have. So on, if we just shift to foodstuffs for a second, a couple of questions. First, just as a setup, does foodstuffs matter if there is jurisdiction by virtue of remittances? I suppose practically it could matter, because if in further discovery it turns out that the remittances doesn't work, then you might need foodstuffs. So I take that point. But just if you divorce it away from that, does it matter? Does it add something to the substantive Title III claim so that we should reach that issue? And second, if we do reach it, then on foodstuffs, why isn't it significant that Allenport is making, as far as the record now shows, entirely independent decisions about where the goods will come from, and that CEMEX, from everything we can tell from the record, doesn't care whether they come from the U.S. It's just by virtue of the independent decision of Allenport that anything from the U.S. is being sold at these locations.
As to the last point, Your Honor, I would submit, with all due respect, that's not what the record says. Mm-hmm. Because Meta says, CEMEX, quote, exercises some degree of discretion in carrying U.S. goods for sale in its convenience stores. CEMEX specifies the product and their amounts that it will purchase from Allenport. And that's in the joint appendix at JA 2073-74.
Right, but that I don't understand why that answers that, because all of that could be true. And what CEMEX says is, we want X product here. Frankly, being a consumer, I'm not sure I get why the seller wouldn't care where the beer comes from or even what brand it is. But let's just stipulate that that's what the record says, because I think it is what the record says. And they just say they want a product. Name the product. I don't care where you get it from. I don't care what brand it is. I don't care what company manufactures it. Just go get me that product. And at that point, I don't think CEMEX is saying we care or is doing anything to indicate that it cares whether the goods come from the U.S. That's all an independent decision by Allenport.
Again, Your Honor, not to quibble, but the record, I don't believe so. The record says CEMEX exercises some degree of discretion in carrying U.S. goods.
Well, of course they do, because I don't think you could just point to the statement in the district court opinion, because the district court has to be relying on something. And I don't think that statement taken at face value tells us that CEMEX actually cares whether something comes from the, of course they have discretion. I mean, they could tell Allenport in their negotiations, we do or don't want good from the U.S. We do or don't want, Tyson's chicken as opposed to something else. We do or do don't want Budweiser. They could do that. But so they have the discretion. But I don't think, as I understand the record, based on that second declaration, the state of the record is that CEMEX just doesn't tell Allenport anything about what brand it wants or where the product is supposed to come from. It just gives it a finite number of a particular product. And it's entirely, let's just assume that that's right. It's entirely Allenport's decision on where to get it from. If there's something in the record that tells me otherwise, I'd be curious to know what that is, but I'm not aware of what that is. And if, besides the district court statement, because that's, for me at least, that's not persuading me that the record says otherwise. So either let me know what in the record says otherwise, or if not, why is it still enough that CEMEX does, I think everybody agrees, CEMEX ultimately does sell goods that come from the U.S. That absolutely is going on. But CEMEX apparently doesn't care whether the goods come from the U.S. That's all Allenport.
Right. Well, As to the record, the Valmana Declaration is what we have, which is at the Joint Appendix of 2074. And according to her, American products reach CEMEX shelves only when CEMEX is placed in order for goods. Allenport, in turn, buys some of the goods CEMEX has ordered from the United States, and CEMEX makes the business decision to carry. So I think, Your Honor, in response to the factual predicate part of your question, you know, that doesn't probably carry me all the way home in that CEMEX is making a decision to buy products from the United States.
Right.
But they certainly know that's happening, and they're not stopping it. And they're shelving, and they're, you know, they're stocking their shelves with these products that come from the United States. So I would say it's more than just happenstance, because to use your example, if they didn't want to stock Budweiser, they could have said, stop bringing that from the United States, but they don't. And they know that products are brought from the United States, money is going into the United States, which we would submit that commercial exchange as a direct effect. And also, Your Honor, I would direct your attention to the EIG case, you know, the Brazilian Petrobras scandal case. The investment loss was actually booked in Luxembourg in that case, but the funds ultimately came to rest in the U.S. And you remember from that case, the court said it doesn't matter if these ricochet around the world, so long as there's an effect found in the U.S. From that, I would submit, Your Honor, that the courts are not as concerned or mindful of this sort of purpose element. It's like, was there a direct effect in the United States? How did it come to happen? And even if there are other effects, or even if there's this ricochet effect, it's still enough.
But it has to be direct still. And I guess, and that's where the rubber hits the road on this, I think, is whether it's a direct effect of the act undertaken by the defendant. And if the act undertaken by the defendant is the sale of goods on its property that were imported from the U.S., does that act have a direct effect on the U.S. where the defendant, based on the existing state of the record, isn't caring whether the goods come from the U.S.?
Well, to me, Your Honor, the answer to that question is, and I hate to answer the question with part of the definition, but is there actually a direct effect?
Mm-hmm.
And whether they purposely bought U.S. products, or sort of were happy to buy U.S. products or happy to shelve them, the question is, was there an effect here? And under the sort of definition that I was working with you, Your Honor, Judge Pillard, that there is, because there's this commercial exchange, funds flowing in, and an impact in the U.S., an effect in the U.S.
Do we know whether CEMEX has to use hard currency from any foreign country from which it buys goods, or are there countries where it doesn't have to use?
I imagine it.
Dollars.
It has to use to buy the products from the U.S., certainly.
Right, but I'm wondering whether it has any reason to buy less from the U.S. where it can because of terms.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then
we haven't talked with you about the expropriation exception and in violation of international law, and I haven't heard from you how you deal with the problem of international law's distinct treatment of shareholders from the SOSA property owner itself and the Barcelona attraction hurdle. And there's some, you know, claims that some of the arguments that you have raised in response are arguments that you did not preserve. And I would just like to briefly hear from you.
Sure, let me do that. But if I could, the one question I didn't answer of yours, Your Honor, is do we have to have both?
Yeah.
Either one is sufficient, in my view, for there to be a direct effect. We'd like to have both, because as lawyers, we always want more. But either one would be sufficient, in our view.
But does it affect? So why would you like to have both? Let's suppose, just by hypothesis, let's go, CEMEX will resist it, but just to carry out this hypothetical, let's suppose you win on remittances.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter to you at all? And let's suppose that win is immune. It can't. It's invulnerable. Does it matter to you at all for purposes of litigating your Title III action whether you also win under the foodstuffs?
In that hypothetical, I don't think it would. I mean, as lawyers, we're almost never willing to make that assumption.
I'm just wondering what the legal consequence is for litigating your, or even practical consequence is for litigating your Title III action, which is what we have ultimately, right, of having more than one foundation for jurisdiction under the FSIA. It seems to me that you think that as long as you get in the door under the FSIA, it could be one gas station that's doing remittances of a non-trivial amount. And then as long as you have that, and as long as that doesn't get overturned at some point, then your Title III action just goes forward as it would.
I believe that is so, but we haven't reached that point.
Sure.
We're defending them both.
Yep, okay.
So, Judge Pillard, in terms of the expropriation exception, again, just to set the stage, that's our second basis under the FSIA claiming immunity to sue these agents or instrumentalities. And the question in particular is what we have complained of, a violation of international law. I mean, we'll deal with that element. There are other elements to the exception, but that's really the one that's before you. Before we even get to Barcelona traction, we would say, the point we've made throughout the proceedings and in the brief below, is that one element of international law, in terms of finding whether this is a violation of international law, is that the taking is not discriminatory. And before we even get into shareholder rights and Barcelona traction and what we can sue, you know, this taking was discriminatory. If we look at Cuba law number 851, which is the operative statute that took the property, which is at the joint appendix at 1127, that was specifically targeted at American companies and particularly mentioned the plaintiff. So we would submit, even under Barcelona traction, Helmer campaign, and the remainder that talk about the entire enterprise exception, that, or the requirement of there being an entire enterprise. We don't even need to get there because this was a discriminatory taking.
But
it violates international law.
But you do, because it violates international law. And the question then becomes, whose international law rights did it violate? And under the distinction between the corporation and its shareholders, it would seem to be the corporation's international law rights. So the corporation, even though it's Panama SOSA, it violates Panama SOSA's rights that its property was taken for a reason that had to do with discrimination against its American owners. But that doesn't change the nature of the shareholders' rights as distinct under Barcelona traction and Diallo and the international law generally, right? So it doesn't get you around that problem, Barcelona traction problem.
Well, but even if it doesn't, into that, Cuba has unlawfully interfered with Exxon's direct right as a shareholder.
By how
interfering
so?
With our beneficial ownership and control of ESSO, and by denying Exxon the economic value of its shares. So we would submit that as a shareholder, we've been injured, and by this
discriminatory— But that's just the diminution.
By this discriminatory take.
Right, that seems like that's just a diminution, and unless there's something that you're asking for in terms of inquiry into municipal law, Panamanian law, that would fill out our understanding of what the shareholders' rights were and how they were, in fact, obstructed. I don't see the distinction yet from Barcelona traction.
Well, we can also question whether Barcelona traction sets an immutable rule that it has to be an entire take. You know, in that case, they posited that there needed to be, but I'm not sure if international law so requires, and that our indirect rights as a shareholder are at issue. And I believe that under international law, which we've cited in our brief, and, you know, and particularly in relying on the ICSID cases and the Iranian Claims Tribunal cases, that our indirect interests are recognized.
A lot of those have to do with rights that flow from a bilateral agreement, and they're the particular reasons of this agreement, not international law writ large. And so if we discount those for that reason, you may have a response to that, but let's just suppose we're discounting for that reason. There's still the question under what everybody agrees is international law, of whether the entire interest has been essentially annulled. And on that, as I understand this course of proceedings, you never made an argument about that in the district court or in our court until the reply brief.
I think that's fair, but the evidence we relied on was defendant's own evidence, which in fact was put into the joint appendix by defendants.
But I think what really for forfeiture purposes, even if the evidence was there to be had or an argument to be made on the basis of it, we expect parties to make the argument.
And I understand that, Your Honor. And I would submit here that given the knowledge of this evidence and the facts that have been before the party, that any notion of undue surprise or other types of procedural argument would not be well found.
So you're requesting that we would not deem that argument to be forfeited here?
Correct. And that's, you know,
you want to finish your
answer? Let me just finish on that, if I could, Your Honor. Just, you know, and that the issues related to that have been, you know, put before you in their motion to strike and our response and then the potential server.
Okay, does FISA or FISA or whatever you call it contain a definition of property?
Does the FSIA contain a definition of property? I'm not sure, Your Honor. But
suppose it doesn't. And why then should not property be defined in accordance with Title III?
Your Honor, we
for
think
for purposes of making the determination about whether the property has been taken in violation of international law, you have to have some idea of what is meant by rights and property. And but I don't see why the definition has to be in terms of some amorphous, international law, when you have a definition of property in the very statute that gives you the cause of action at a minimum.
Well, we would agree, Your Honor, and push that point a little further too.
And I might add that the definition of property is employed in Title III for the purpose of determining whether there's been an expropriation, whether there's been a confiscation.
Right, Your Honor. And then the Claims Commission has certified that amount, and then Title III gives us a right to sue to enforce that right. And if I could talk briefly about Title III, as you know, an alternative basis that we've posited is that we have subject matter jurisdiction under Title III, that Title III itself gives us a right to sue without regard to the FSIA. So that if we were correct, we wouldn't even need to deal with these questions of exceptions under the FSIA. And our argument is fairly straightforward on the Helms-Burton Act's subject matter jurisdiction. One, it allows for suits against agencies or instrumentalities of foreign government. And, you know, the 28 U.S. as codified in 28 U.S.C. 6082, it goes who are entitled to sue. And we're entitled to sue any person. And that person is defined to include an agent or instrumentality of a foreign state. So, but that isn't alone enough or the extent of our argument. The question then becomes, because there's obviously ample jurisprudence, starting with Armada Hess and other cases, that say the FSIA is the only basis under which you can sue a sovereign. And there are cases like Armada Hess and others where they have found that other claims can't be brought outside of the FSIA. Here we would submit this is a circumstance under which, even with Armada Hess, that we should be allowed to proceed with subject matter jurisdiction under Title III itself.
The district court relied upon that case, I think, was decided in 1989, where the Supreme Court said that the FSIA is the sole source for allowing jurisdiction over foreign sovereigns. And it does seem to me that that's a misnomer in itself, because I don't see sovereign immunity as a jurisdictional question. It can be waived, but the court was a lot looser in those days. And labeling things from jurisdiction. But nevertheless, that was decided in 1989. This statute came into effect in 1996. So the statement by the Supreme Court, which has been repeated, but could not possibly have anticipated a suit against of the sort that you're bringing now under Title III. And the other thing that I'd like you to address is that the fact of the matter is that the Title III is a specific statute aimed just at Cuba. FISA is aimed at the world. And there's a doctrine of interpretation that says that the specific controls over the general. And I'm not sure that you've made that argument, but I'd like you to address.
Well, yes, Your Honor. We believe that as a later enacted statute after Armada Hess, which is the 1989 case, and with it specifically tailored to this precise situation, that it doesn't run afoul of the Supreme Court's teachings on FSIA. And in fact, if we dive more deeply into Title III, I think that position becomes even clearer. Because if you assume, as the district court did, that we can only sue under the FSIA, there are a number of references within Title III that would then be unnecessary. And I don't think we should conclude that Congress put unnecessary references. For example, in Title III, there's a particular provision that says, as to a sovereign, it's in the procedural requirements section of Title III, which is at 28 USC 6082C. There are particular provisions there that have been added to deal with service of process on a sovereign. In that section, the Congress said the service of process over an agency or instrumentality of a foreign state shall be done like it is under Title 16, in 1608 of Title 28, in other words, the FSIA. So, and similarly, there are provisions in this procedural section that deal with attachment and execution against Cuban property. 6082D deals about enforceability of judgments against the Cuban government and says, if there's been, essentially, if there's been a regime change, you can't enforce a Helms-Burton judgment against the new government. And there was a provision that was in 608, in section 302E, which then became 6082E, that became codified in the FSIA that dealt with certain property of the Cuban state that could not be attached. That is diplomatic property.
Diplomatic missions.
Right.
Yeah. So, facilities used.
So my point is, if Congress intended plaintiffs like us, in order to sue an agent or instrumentality, had to go under the FSIA, it would have been completely unnecessary to put these other provisions in Helms-Burton. Because in Helms-Burton now, there are specific provisions that say, if you sue an agent, one, you have the right to sue an agent or instrumentality. Two, if you sue an agent or an instrumentality, these are the things we've taken from the FSIA that you have to follow. If we...
And three, it assumes that a judgment will be enforceable, which is contrary to the idea that sovereign immunity would protect against it.
Because as you know, under the FSIA, there are a number of provisions that deal with how to enforce a judgment against a sovereign or its agents or instrumentality. If we were only to follow the FSIA, these provisions that I'm going through would be unnecessary. And there's also a catch-all provision in that describes the interplay between Helms-Burton and the FSIA in Section 1, 302C1.
I don't understand the unnecessary point. I mean, for example, C2, which is service of process, and it says you'll serve process as process is served under the FSIA.
Right.
I mean, it might be unnecessary in the sense that you're just doing what the FSIA says you should do for service of process, but it's also not doing anything different. So it's entirely consistent with having the FSIA as the font of jurisdiction.
Here's what I take from that. If what the district court said is actually the law, that we can only sue under the FSIA, and that Helms-Burton did not create a ability to sue a sovereign. You wouldn't need to put these provisions in because they are already found in the FSIA. What I would submit is that the reverse is true. Congress knew that we could sue an agent or instrumentality without regard to the FSIA. So what they did was they imported a handful of provisions from the FSIA and put them in Helms-Burton. Because if they didn't do that under our view of the world, we'd be able to execute on our judgment against Cuban diplomatic mission. Because
can you go,
it's
not can you
otherwise
go against
immune.
Could you go against another sovereign under Title III?
If another sovereign was trafficking in our property.
Yeah. Do you think that Title III, if it's Title III, is an additional font of jurisdiction entirely regardless of the FSIA, as your argument presupposes? Suppose some other sovereign comes into possession because of some agreement with Cuba of property and is engaging in trafficking on that property. You get to go against...
I think that... One, I would think the contemplation would have been that Cuba is the only sovereign in town when it comes to the Helms-Burton. And then your question would be, hypothetically, if another sovereign was trafficking in expropriated property, could we sue them without regard to the FSIA? We would submit it does create a cause of action.
No, they couldn't. You could not sue another sovereign. You can't even sue Cuba under this.
We can just sue an agent or instrumentality.
Yeah, that's right. All you can sue is an agent or instrumentality.
The person is defined as an agent or instrumentality.
Okay, an agent or instrumentality of another sovereign.
Let's say of Venezuela, yeah. whom Cuba has sold some, you know, oil infrastructure.
If it were an agent or instrumentality of a foreign state.
Would that proceed under Title III, I think the question is, or would that proceed under the FSIA?
Well, we haven't considered that possibility yet. We would submit that Title III gives us a right to sue. I think in that situation, you know, the question would be, did Congress contemplate a waiver of sovereign immunity with respect to someone other than a Cuban agent or instrument?
Well, if the Cuban government had brought in some entity from Russia to operate the oil refinery, I don't see any reason why you would resist that. I think it's absolutely covered by this.
I mean, it would fall under the definition of person, and Congress did not make any other provisions with respect to certain Cuban, you know, other non-sovereigns, but we would have, in that hypothetical, Your Honor, we would have to follow the provisions that are imported to Title III from the FSIA, like venue. And remember, there are other provisions.
It's not so hypothetical, by the way, but that's another issue.
Right.
So can I take you back to a question I asked earlier and apply it to this too? On this axis of your argument that there's an independent basis for getting jurisdiction over a Cuban entity via Title III, does it matter to you whether the way you get to go forward in your Title III action is that Title III creates jurisdiction or that it's a remittance at one station that gets you under commercial activity? Does it matter?
It doesn't matter, and it would be, I mean, we would prefer to go simply under Title III because then we wouldn't have to deal with the commercial activity and the remittances, all these other things with respect to the creation of jurisdiction. So
why would you, but I don't understand why you'd prefer it. I mean, just to give you the cleanest hypothetical, I'm just hypothetically guaranteeing you a win under one of these. Do you care?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to understand the way you were conceptualizing this vis-a-vis.
I like the Helms-Burton argument, but no, I don't.
Yeah. Okay.
So, if I could save a few minutes for rebuttal.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions at this point. Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Krinsky, we'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll give 3 minutes for the cross-appeal rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to try to cover a couple of points. On direct effect, what strikes me is that a lot of the inquiry and a lot of the argument is on a question that Judge Mehta did not find. What is the effect, if any, caused by the 4 to 10 service stations? What is the effect of CMEX carrying these goods on their shelves? And there's a whole lot of, and we say on the record, we should have won on both points, but in any event, he did not make the findings which are necessary to sustain direct effect. And so at a minimum, we would suggest a remand for that. Those determinations is necessary. Let me see. Also on the direct effect, Judge Mehta did mention trivial, but that wasn't in the sense of causation. He assumed incorrectly, as error, we believe, that setting this Western Union FinCEMEX setting up these channels of remittances was the effect, and the remittances flowed that was as a result of that. That was the effect. And then the question he asked was the amount of those remittances trivial? But that's not the question. The question is whether Western Union FinCEMEX setting up these channels of remittance, the direct effect of CMEX using these 4 to 10 stations. And so the trivial point he addressed is actually a different point. As to the 4 to 10, I want to make it clear on the record, we have not admitted that there are even 4 to 10. What we said is there are no more than 4 to 10 because we've looked at the property records, and except for those 4 to 10, we see no trace of SOSA land. We haven't admitted even 4 to 10. On the question on the parcel owner property right question about the taking of the property by the entirety, Judge Mehta did make findings on that, and on the basis of absolutely sufficient evidence. He said management and control was not taken. That stayed with SOSA, with Exxon as its shareholders until 2012. And he said because there was property and business outside of Cuba, and he pointed to Panama and Jamaica, the entirety of the business was not taken. Exxon's ownership of the corporation had not been completely destroyed. And that's the standard the United States has maintained, and which Helmrich accepted. Its shares were not useless. It was still operating this company. So on the question of rights under shareholder rights, it seems Judge Mehta has laid that to rest with his findings, unless the plaintiffs can argue it was clear error, and it was not clear.
Thank you.
On this business of Title III and the service division, the answer is easy. It was abundance of portion. Title III, when that provision was put in, it was when the jurisdiction of Title III was changed from exclusive federal jurisdiction to state court concurrent jurisdiction. And so out of abundance of caution, Congress may have been concerned that state courts would not issue default judgments without paying attention to the service division. And in fact, it had been warned by the State Department there were going to be lots of default judgments, again, by agencies. And so
there's no concurrent jurisdiction.
Yes, there
is. If you bring a case under Title III, there's a provision in Title III that bars you from bringing an action under common law, any other federal law, or any state law.
But it can be brought in state court. Title III lawsuits can be brought in state court. They have been brought in state court.
But it have to be under Title III.
Under Title III?
Yeah.
I think to address your question about whether Exxon should care about whether the judgment is under Title III or the FSIA. Well, I think the answer is that they should care, because if it's under Title III, they cannot obtain execution on the judgment except by conforming with the FSIA's provisions about 1609 establishes immunity from jurisdiction, except when the judgment is under one of the specified exemptions from suit. So Title III judgment gets them no execution. Two other points, and because...
you could be brief, please.
Yes, first, I don't even... Just to mention, Your Honor, on the expropriation exception along controls, we argue statutory construction and we argue international law. And we do believe they are both really quite important. Statutory construction, expropriation exception addresses this very conduct. Operate an agency engaged in commerce operating expropriated property. And it lays down very hard, specific conditions for a lawsuit on that. Commercial activity exception doesn't address that. It's literal terms, it sweeps as far as operation of expropriated property, and yet without the conditions that Congress has imposed. One pitch for international law, Your Honor, we suggest that in this area particularly, it is really important and should be paid close attention to. Allowing suit by a former owner, which Exxon is not actually, but allowing suit by a former owner against an agency for using expropriated property commercially, I think we have demonstrated, would be contrary to international law at the time of the FSIA's enactment. There was no abrogation of immunity for that. So we would be placing this lawsuit well beyond radical departure from customary international law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Davidson, we'll give you... Okay. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.